Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for April 7, 2005. I will also open a hearing on SB 5509, the Department of Education, and SB 5510, the Department of Education State School Fund. Ladies and gentlemen, this morning I want to welcome you all here. All my committee members are really glad to have you here. We have our normal situation for a daytime hearing during session. We have 2 hours in which to conduct this hearing. Then members to my right, including myself, will have to be on the Senate floor. Members to my left in the House probably have other appointments and soon will have to be on the House floor. So we only have 2 hours in which to conduct testimony. I put out three sheets at first for testimony, and we had planned on that being like one party for each line, but there are some where there are multiple parties on the same line. We will try to get through the first three sheets. There's been a fourth sheet put out, but I do not know if we will be able to get through that in the 2 hours allotted. I just wanted to put that on the record, so if unfortunately you may be disappointed at the end, but we may not get any farther than the first three sheets that were put out. Also, we're going to limit testimony to no more than 3 minutes. If you have written testimony and it's longer than 3 minutes, please try to paraphrase the testimony. I will actually, unfortunately, to be fair to other parties that are here to testify, I will have to stop people at 3 minutes. So please attempt to complete your testimony in that period of time. The first party I'd like to call up will be Dr. Barry Albertson.
Mr. Devlin, how are you? Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Barry Albertson. I'm a parent of three children in the Tiger 12 School District, a ninth grader, a seventh grader, and a fifth grader. I'm also a member of the Tiger 12 School Board, and I'm an unwavering supporter of public education. I do not plan to waste your time this morning reiterating messages that you've already heard from so many concerned parents, teachers, school administrators, school board members about large class sizes, the loss of important core curriculum and elective course programs, inadequate funding, or our inability to receive from you a definitive, concrete public education budget so that we can craft our own budgets at our own school districts, but to describe to you perhaps a different perspective regarding public education. Today, public education expects our teachers and our administrators constantly to take up the slack, to teach more and more kids who need more and more help. It appears that far too many of Oregon's children are poised to fall through the cracks simply because they come to school straddling those cracks. And when this happens, the blame is uniformly placed at the feet of public education and on our teachers. Our educators deal more and more with special needs children, children who have learning disabilities, dyslexia, attention deficit problems, language who move into and out of the school district at a very high frequency, kids whose first language is not English, kids who come from struggling single-parent families, kids coming from struggling two-parent families, kids who just need a confidant, someone to talk to, someone to help them stay focused, someone to rely on, someone they can trust. And more of these kids turn to their teachers in public schools. Teachers and administrators are now expected to be counselors, psychologists, nutritionists, public health workers, physical fitness experts, social workers, protectors, and confidants. And when the dust settled, they're expected to be fundraisers. Those of us who are inside our schools right now know all too well that our teachers have been doing these extended and expanded jobs for years, but it's getting harder and harder for them with their class sizes bulging with the financial constraints that the state of Oregon is placing upon them. If you in the state of Oregon expect public education or any educational system to be successful, you first must define what you expect that system to do for Oregon's kids. Second, you must find out what society and parents' expectations are. Third, you must know what our educators are actually facing and trying to do inside our schools and classrooms. And lastly, and this is the most important part, you must support public education in a financially substantive and truly adequate way. You can haggle over and dance around numbers like $5.4 billion and $5.325 billion, and numbers I saw in the paper this morning in the Oregonian, $5.175 billion. dollars for K-12 education and keep us in suspense forever. But until you grasp the clear message stated in your own quality education model of what it truly costs to educate our children, yours is an exercise in shadow boxing, and ours, unfortunately, is an exercise in futility. Please, please start listening to your classroom educators, to the teachers in those classrooms, and begin in earnest to help them. And when you do, ladies and gentlemen, you will see what public education and your teachers can do for Oregon's economy, for Oregon's future, and for Oregon's most precious resource, our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sir,
we have some questions.
Oh, you want to?
Like a
school
building.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. And thank you very much for coming. And I appreciate you didn't mention one thing, as ours is an exercise in shadow boxing, and yours is, well, I guess you did say an exercise in futility. But, you know, in the last session, the legislature did step up. We passed a tax increase, helped fund public schools. The voters didn't go along with us. They said no. We're in a situation where Oregon has turned down a sales tax 9 times. If we go out and send one out to the public, and what's your answer to educating the public so that they would potentially vote for more taxes or some way or another to fund schools? I mean, the educators understand everything. These legislators understand everything you said. I mean, we visit schools. We see what the teachers are doing. We understand that you guys are doing a good job. Our futility or our shadow boxing is the fact that when we did the thing that we thought was right, the voters said no. So how do you go out and convince the voters that to change their mind?
Then you have to go out and convince them. That's exactly what you have to do, and I believe that's what we elected you to do.
They elect us.
That's true. But the fact of the matter is,
let me just before, there are certain people in this area that they were in that session last session that are no longer with us. Those are the people that stepped up and that did the right thing. So you can say that's our job, but there's, I don't know, how many thousands. I think maybe we both have a responsibility. In the school districts yourself, you talk to local community people. Why do people don't think schools are worth voting for?
Well, they do in Tuolumne, and I'll use that as a template. We have been supported by our communities over and over again with ballot measures, with local option taxes, and with bonds. And we're doing, but we're still struggling. We're looking right now. We had our first budget committee meeting yesterday, 24 and so people, and we're looking at cutting $3 million from our budget. That's going to be teachers. And so it's up to you and also to us to convince the public that this is the best money spent. This is for their future as older people, speaking for myself, and I'm no spring chicken, and for everybody in between. This money is the best money you can spend, and it needs to be more. And you've got to find ways, all of you have to find ways, to get that money into the schools, literally into teachers, more teachers, and into the classroom.
Thank
and
you.
So I will take that responsibility, too, and I preach the gospel just like you do.
Thank you for that message. And, members, I'm going to ask us to move on. We have a lot of testimony to a lot of members of the public to hear from. And we have a group that has traveled more than 100 miles. And that panel is made up of Donna Schnitger.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Donna Schnitger, Annie Soto, and Corey. And I'm sorry, I cannot read the last name. Please come forward.
May I comment while they're coming?
Certainly.
I'd like to echo a little bit of Senator Nelson's point and remind the audience that Senator Nelson's hometown did vote for ballot measure 30, which I'm not sure about the Tuolumne School District, but I know what the city of Pendleton did.
Thank you very much, Representative Jensen. Mr. Nelson, please introduce your panel.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Head Start Association. As all of you know, and I've conversed with all of you, we have a $14 million hole in the department's budget. $11 million was cut from that budget in the governor's budget for Head Start. That translates into with the increase, the percentage increase in COLA to about $14 million that we're short from continuing the program as we know it today. I want to introduce three individuals, Annie Soto, who is the director of the Eugene Head Start program and president of the Oregon Head Start Association, Corey Brune, who is a parent from Salem, and Don Schnitker, who heads up the Burns Head Start program. They will provide you some personal information as well as some data regarding longitudinal studies and some recent data from Oregon Head Start programs throughout the state. Annie?
Thank you.
Thank you, and this is just a reminder to please keep your testimony to 3 minutes if you're wearing a watch. Please, thank you, and welcome.
Good morning, members. In 1990, the wisdom of your predecessors in Salem brought to every county in the state quality early childhood education, and in the form of the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, which is a Head Start look-alike. When the governor spoke in the State of the State, he addressed the importance of pre-K through 12 in terms of education. There have been several longitudinal studies that really address the positive effects of a quality early childhood program with comprehensive services. About a month ago, the Children's Institute brought to both Portland and to Salem Dr. Larry Schweinhart, president of the HiSCOPE Research Foundation. And he shared information regarding the HiSCOPE 40-year longitudinal study, the Perry Preschool Study, and talking about the effects of early childhood quality early childhood education. Some of the findings were that more of the children who had that education graduated from high school. Fewer young women had, well, they weren't young after 40 years. Fewer females had less mental health impairment or had to repeat a grade. And the group who received early childhood education at the ages of 9, 15, 20, and 27 showed that their literacy and abilities to comprehend were continued to excel above people who have not had that experience. The FACES study, and that's the Family and Child Experience Survey that was mandated by Congress. The results in the year 2000 showed that Head Start graduates by the spring of kindergarten year were at national norms in early reading and writing, close to national norms in math and vocabulary knowledge, and that their reading assessment scores reach the national norm. And that is outstanding for children who may have had experiences that were not helping their education when they were very young. And in this state, we currently serve about 10,000 young children and their family, the combination of federal and state dollars. We hope that you all will look to fill that hole. The money that was taken out of our budget will decrease services to about 50% of eligible families. We had reached 60%, and we sincerely want to continue to serve the poorest of Oregon's poor children and families. They deserve a quality early childhood education.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hi. Excuse me. My name is Corey Bruin, and I am a Head Start parent. I have four boys. One is in Head Start right now, and two will be in Head Start, hopefully, in the future. There's so much that I'd like to say, but instead I just wrote down a few things, and I'm just going to read them. I have always had a big respect for Head Start and their mission. Being a daycare provider and mother for myself, there has never been any question of importance or value of the program. I feel blessed that I have been able to experience the difference Head Start can make in a child and their family's life. Since being a part of the Head Start family, I've learned a lot about myself and my child. I've also had the chance to learn more about the resources our community has to offer. My son, Noah, has changed so much in just the past few months. Noah is happier, healthier, stronger, and actually has a true joy for school and friends. Noah has gained self-confidence and learned so much that will probably stay with him for the rest of his life. He has learned about independence and compassion and has gained the knowledge and skills he will need to be one step ahead and succeed in his upcoming school years. I have learned that Head Start is not a daycare center, but a school and a home in one. Head Start has been a real blessing and has allowed me to be involved in Noah's life in ways that I never imagined I could be. I am currently vice president of the parent committee at my child's site. I also serve as vice chair on the policy council, and I have also become an active member of the board of directors for the entire community action agency. My husband has also become our site rep for male involvement committee. We have been able to attend many trainings that have further prepared us for future parent leadership roles in the Head Start as well as at home. And we hope to encourage other parents to get involved in their child's lives and experience the difference that Head Start and being involved can make for their families. Through Head Start, I have gained more confidence and, most importantly, hope for my whole family. I am so grateful to Head Start, who has allowed me to be so involved in my child's life in such important ways. I pray that Head Start will continue to be around and touch the lives of others the way they have touched ours. I believe that a good Head Start in life is essential and irreplaceable in raising tomorrow's leaders. In closing, I ask you all to remember that a good Head Start today, I believe, is key to preventing the need for intervention tomorrow. Thank you for your time.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Senator Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Donna Schnitker. I'm the Head Start Director in Harney County. And I am going to talk about the brochure that we handed out to you this morning. This shows a sampling of approximately 1,100 children in Oregon. And if I could direct you to the inside, we have chosen 3 out of 7 domains and targeted it for the brochure because these are the questions we are typically asked, which is, are children ready to read? And it shows here that we assess 71 skills 3 times a year. And it shows at the beginning of school, at the bottom graph, the green shows the easiest skills, the purple shows the intermediate skills, and the yellow shows the most difficult skills. And it shows at the beginning of the school year, more children are in the green and purple areas, and not too many are in the yellow area. However, at the end of this school year, we show that the green is dropped down to probably 10%, whereas the yellow has increased from about 60%. So it shows that children are making definite progress over the year. The second one is the math skills, which people always want to know, are they developing math skills to enter kindergarten? And it shows here that at the beginning of the year again, that they are able to do the easy skills, but by the end of the year they've developed an ability to do the most difficult ones, and it shows that more are doing the difficult ones than not. And the last one is always the social-emotional, which is on the back. And social-emotional development is, we look at taking turns, being guided by adults, being able to negotiate and problem solve for yourself. And again, it shows that at the beginning of the year, more children are in the easy area than in the difficult one. And by the end of the year, there are very few that can't master all of those skills. We've also provided you with some numbers to call if you have any questions. And on the inside, the Galileo program, which is the assessment tool that is used to develop this information, they have a website, and it's listed on the bottom of the third page, right down here. And they have all of the domains listed there with a lot of information about our Oregon-specific study. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'd like to call up a panel. I'd like to call up a panel. Shady, it looks like Shardy Lewis.
Sharon
Lewis. It's, Jamie Birch and Tracy. And then on deck, so to speak, Cassandra Wilson, Joyce Rosenow, Steve Destrude, and Lori Wimmer Whalen.
Lori's outside.
Oh, she's in back.
Oh, she's inside now?
Yes.
Okay. I was just talking to her outside.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Mark Paul.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sharon Lewis, and I am here representing families who receive early intervention, early childhood special education services. My daughter, Zoe, would like to speak first, and then we'll follow up with a few more remarks.
My name is Zoe, and I have a speech I want to say. My name is Zoe. When I was little, I needed extra help to do things, and now I am big. I have my teachers like Christine in preschool. School is lots of fun. My friends are. I like riding the bikes. I play drums. I went to Disney World on my spring for my spring break. I met Mickey Mouse and Jimmy because he gave me big hugs, lots of big hugs. I went on the Dumbo and I met Cecil a lot of times. My preschoolers helped my mom and me. And lots of things. I want to learn how to talk and how to read my letters and my numbers, and now I can read books and can do math. I think the little kids need preschool too. My friend Emily gives preschool. She likes it too. Thanks for helping kids give great preschools.
Thank you.
Good job. Zoe is a graduate of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education program in Portland, and having had a very difficult and traumatic first 3 years of life. She comes here today to help you understand how important this program is to our kids and what a successful program it is, and we basically wanted to thank you. I do have written testimony. I apologize I didn't provide it. And we just wanted to put a face on the program. The program serves children birth to five who have a variety of disabilities. It's part of the grants and aid budget. And there are approximately 7,300 kids in the state of Oregon who receive these services. And Oregon has been one of the states that has had a long tradition of supporting these services, and we wanted to thank you for continuing that support.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Birch, and my family and I live in Portland, where my youngest daughter, Carly, who is 20 months, receives early intervention services. I am co-founder of the Open Arms Playgroup for children birth to five with Down syndrome, and I'm also a board member of the Northwest Down Syndrome Association. Our family, has been involved in early intervention since my daughter was a week old. At that point, you know, we just kind of had an introduction and such, but since then, Carly has reached many milestones, and she is a very busy girl. I just wanted to come today to also thank everyone for the support, the continued support, and tell a little bit about some of the things that Carly has reached with the information that I have learned through the early intervention program. I have learned different techniques and things to do with Carly since she was really little, things that have helped her learn to roll, sit up by herself, and walk now. She's starting to walk. She took her first steps 3 weeks ago. So all the important things that I, you know, got information from them and different tips, and they supported us through the whole thing. So it's really been a beneficial part of our family. And She, you know, has a lot of determination and spirit, and I have written testimony, but I just wanted to tell a little bit about that. And I want the best for my daughters, my children, and I know that Early Intervention Program does too. So I support them, and thank you also for supporting them. Thank you.
Good morning, Senators and members of the committee. I'm Tracy Bowler, and this is my son, Brogan, and we live in Silverton, and he is a hard-of-hearing child. I'm about 50% deaf, and with the help of early intervention, thank goodness for them, we received his first pair of hearing aids when he was 18 months old. At the time, we couldn't afford to buy them. They're not covered by insurance for children, but they provided them for us. They also sent a hearing specialist out 3 times a month to show us how to operate them, maintain them, check them, and help him learn how to keep them on and not turn them off as he got older and learn to do that. Very selectively. They also sent out an audiology van with an audiologist so we wouldn't have to make the 50-minute trip into Salem to where they would adjust his frequency digitally, provide new ear molds, do new fitting tubes if he needed them. And currently, he just started the preschool at Salem Heights for the deaf and hard of hearing. And they teach him sign language. They let the children go there who aren't potty trained, thank goodness, because he's definitely not. They have a speech specialist, a pathologist actually. He's actually the teacher. They have another hearing specialist that comes in, an audiologist that will make most of his appointments there, so we no longer have to have 4 different appointments every month. And I just wanted to let you know how important it is for us for him to be there. And we do live out in the hills, and they also transport him every day, and it's 50 minutes one way. And that's pretty critical for us because we have a little one-year-old at home as well. So I just want to let you know how important early intervention is, and we can't imagine them not being there for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cassandra Wilson, Joyce Rosenow, Steve Dushkide, and Lori Wimmer Whalen.
I make a comment on the record. There is a Senate bill that would require insurance companies to pay for hearing aids. I don't know if it's moving or not.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Check with Senator Brown's office.
Great. Thank you.
And then on deck will be, looks like, Sue Lynn Merrick and Don Washburn and Molly Adams.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'd like to have you know I'm Cassandra Wilson. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I teach at Applegate Elementary in North Portland, and the OEA has asked me to come and read a testimony to you. If the legislator agrees to the governor's original proposal of $5 billion, it would force Portland Public Schools to eliminate more than 400 school staff positions next year. I am a professional educator at a small elementary school in North Portland, Applegate. This neighborhood is a low socioeconomic area. Our staff is committed to help our students become well-rounded, active learners, and to understand the love of learning. We have some students at our school who experience chaos in their home life. Because of Applegate's small size, our staff is able to know each student's name, be familiar with their family and home life situations. Every child knows they can go to any staff member and be nurtured and understood. We have accomplished this goal year after year, although it gets more difficult each year as our resources diminish. Applegate will be closed in June and will be merging with the larger school, Woodlawn Elementary. With the proposed major cut, the impact on our students will be immense. There will no longer be small schools such as Applegate in every neighborhood. The following will either be reduced or eliminated: class size, child development specialist, educational assistance, library, music, PE, study clubs. All of these programs are needed to provide our students with a safe learning environment and to close the achievement gap in our public schools. And I'd like to add just one personal story of my classroom. I had a lovely child named Ontario, African-American young man who came to me in fourth grade. He could not speak, or he would not speak. He would not read. He could not read. He wouldn't speak in front of the classroom. He couldn't write. I was lucky enough to loop with them in the fifth grade. With all of our staff members knowing Ontario, whether they're a first grade teacher, fifth grade teacher, third grade teacher, special ed teacher, ESL teacher, with our positive aspects to all of our students, get individual help from all of our teachers. And now Ontario, I'm proud to say, exceeded in the state math assessment. He is now reading at a first grade level, but before he couldn't read a word. He couldn't talk to a one-on-one. Now he's in front of my classroom, speaking in front of the class, demonstrating his expertise. And everybody's proud of him. And there's so many students at Applegate that have these special needs, not that they need the special needs as far as ERC, but our staff is small, the school is small, and we can touch every child, every single child at Applegate. And this low socioeconomic areas, they need small schools, they need dedicated teachers that cares about every single student. And I'd say my classroom, and what I mean by my classroom is my entire school. Thank you.
I am Joyce Rosenow. I've been a teacher in the Reynolds School District since 1996. I also live in the district, and all of my children attended school there. I'm here to talk about some of the funding impacts on my district. In the past several years, we've had to make some cuts. In 2002-2003, we lost 8 school days. Also, that same year, we were not allowed to be in our buildings after 4 o'clock, which meant that we could not hold any after-school programs. We had to cancel our music programs. Our PTO, our Latino parent nights were unable to meet. Community groups couldn't use our facilities for, sometimes the Y rents it out for sports activities. None of that was allowed to go on in order for us to save money. That same year, we were also told that we were supposed to limit our use of the copy machine. And so I had to spend a lot of time writing stuff on the board. So instead of spending time actually giving instruction, my students had to spend time copying stuff off the board. Parents were so concerned that they actually came to school with reams of paper to give us so that we could produce homework for our students. We've also been delayed in our textbook adoptions. As you may know, textbooks have to be reviewed. Curriculum has to be reviewed every 7 years. When our science adoption came up, we didn't have enough money to buy the textbooks that would be needed for our whole district, and so we received a waiver, so we have not renewed our science curriculum since then. We also reduced the number and the time and money spent on professional development because it was really important in our district to keep our money in our classrooms and for our students. However, the good news is that the Reynolds School District has benefited because we are receiving money from the Multnomah iTax. However, this is next year will be the last year that we receive that, and we are looking at losing $11 million. There is no way that we can save $11 million by turning off the lights at 4 o'clock and by refusing to make copies for children. When we lose the $11 million, we will lose staff. And all the school now, as we sit in our meetings, we are wondering where those cuts are going to come. Who are they going to cut? Up till now, we have had, fortunately, been one of the schools that still have actual PE teachers, music teachers, and librarians and counselors in our schools. Now we are wondering whether or not those are luxuries that we are going to have to give up. We've worked to keep our class sizes low, but right now, many of our elementary classes sit at 28 students and above. A lot of classes are over 30, and our school district is growing. My own school will need to add another third grade class next year, but we have no room for them. Currently now, I teach in a portable, and many of our schools have portables. But without knowing about our funding, where our funding is coming from, is it going to be stable, can we count on it, the school district can't go out and hire new people and build new buildings because we won't know whether or not we will have means to staff them. So I was just here to talk about the impacts and the changes that will come in our district in the next year if we are not adequately funded. Thank you.
Can I ask members of the audience not to clap after each party testifies? I know it's a natural thing to do, given the nature of the testimony. But here in the legislature, it's not normal decorum to clap after each speaker. And if we want to get into a freedom of speech issue, if people were here booing and I was allowing people to clap, I'd have to allow them to boo also. And I've been in committees where there have been people in the audience that would be hissing at the people testifying. Clearly not here. So please don't clap after each party speaks. Please proceed.
Good morning, Senator Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Steve Dustrud, and I live and teach in Springfield, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today about such an important topic. Oregon's children are our most valuable resource, and they're certainly entitled to the best public education we can provide them. I've been a speech-language pathologist in the Springfield School District for the past 30 years, and both of my children have graduated from Thurston High School in Springfield, so I have a great deal of firsthand knowledge about the Springfield School District. Even though our formal budget hearings have not occurred as yet in Springfield in attending work sessions, I've been informed that even if the legislature provides state funding based on a $5.4 billion level, that Springfield will be down 21 teaching staff over where they were 4 years ago. $5.4 billion will only allow us to tread water. From a classroom teacher standpoint, it's quite simple. We have larger classes of students and students with ever-increasing needs. Over the last 4 years, our percentage of special needs students has increased by 20%. During that same time, we've had a 133% increase in students who are ELL, English language learners, non-English speaking students. Also during that period, our percentage of students who fall below the poverty line has increased from 41% to 55%. Over half of our students fall below the poverty line. These students present unique challenges to us in educating them. Since 2001-2002, the Springfield School District has made tremendous cuts in a variety of areas, including administration, athletics and activities, night school, summer school, co-curricular, supplies and materials. I pretty much work at the elementary level, and I can tell you that the supplies and materials issue is a big one for elementary teachers. Nationally, the average teacher spends over $500 a year of their own money for supplies and materials for their classroom. I have colleagues in Springfield who I know spend much more than that to provide what their students need. If a state K-12 budget of $5 billion is adopted, this would result in approximately 25 additional teaching positions lost in Springfield. Also, a 45% cut in our athletics and activities budget. The average class size for grades K-3 would rise to 27 this next school year. Now, I'm here to tell you that having 27 students in a kindergarten class is ridiculous. Yet in Springfield, I have colleagues who have 29 in a kindergarten class. I have colleagues that have over 35 students in fifth grade classes. A $5.1 billion funding level would still find us $2.4 million short of what we need to provide an adequate education program. For 2005-2006, we have already cut, a very successful alternative regional program for middle and high school students called the Turnaround School, which teaches students who have been through the juvenile justice system. The cost of cutting such a program, or the cost of a program such as this, is quite high. But the ultimate cost to those students and our community will be much higher in the future. So what happens if the governor's budget, what happens in Springfield if the funding is increased from the governor's original proposal of $5.0 billion? Well, in Springfield, each additional $100 million at the state level generates about $900,000 to $1 million to the Springfield School District. $1 million supports approximately 3 days of operation, 15 certified staff. It would lower the class size across the district by one student per class. It would provide K-8 after-school programs with educational and recreational components. Again, even if we were to receive a $5.4 billion state funding level, Springfield would be down 21 full-time teachers over where we were 4 years ago. I urge you to support K-12 funding at a level of $5.4 billion or more. The retirement gifts that the Teacher Association in Springfield provides retiring teachers includes an engraved quote from teacher astronaut Krista McAuliffe, who died in the tragic Challenger space shuttle accident. That quote reads, "I touch the future. I teach. Oregon's children are its future, and we should do no less than provide adequate and stable funding for their education." Thank you.
If one of the panelists will leave, Lori Wimmer will come up, and actually we'll get the next panel up also. Lori, come up.
Mr. Chair, as the panels are switching, may I ask the audience a question, please?
Yes.
I'd like to know how many people present would support a sales tax dedicated to education, pre-K through higher education, and how many would not support a sales tax dedicated to education, pre-K through higher education? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Lori, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. I've been told that if a person wishes to boil a frog, it's futile to drop the animal in hot water because he'll jump out of the pot. To boil a frog, apparently you must begin with tepid water, and the frog will sit in it, oblivious to the gradual temperature increase until it's too late. This state has done a good job of boiling frogs when it comes to public education. We believe that it's escaped the notice of many citizens that public education has marched silently but steadily downward. Since 1992, in inflation-adjusted dollars, Oregon has reduced its investment in the next generation by $611 per student. Yet some in this august body would ask us to trim another $102 per student in only a two-year period, the next biennium. That's what a budget of $5.175 billion means in the context of these times. Education is an investment in Oregon's economy, its future, its hopes, and its dreams. We've pared those dreams by $800 million over the last 3 years during the recession, and we've also failed to underwrite our legislated ambitions through the Education Act of the 21st Century in the 15 years since its passage. Schools have repeatedly responded by scrambling to manage, as you've heard from several of our members in these last two panels. Some educators have worked for free. They've contributed more than $32 million in foregone salary just in the 2002-03 school year alone. Some have lost school days. The number in 2002-03 was 422, which is 10,788,689 hours, instructional hours, to students lost in that school year, and at least 57 days more in 03-04. Some districts have lost staff positions, as you've heard from countless people who've come before you in the last few weeks. Our members have compensated for eviscerated supplies budgets, which you've also heard, by buying classroom materials from their own pockets. Parents and community members have also stepped up in support. One prominent citizen now hangs the original drawing of a very painful Doonesbury cartoon on her living room wall. She purchased it for a hefty bid at a school auction to support the schools. Students have pitched in with fundraisers of their own and volunteerism. They now pay to play in most extracurricular activities. In my own child's middle school, the grounds are tended not by the district, but by parents and students who euphemistically call themselves the Garden Club. My son and I have hauled and shared our share of bark dust along with the rest of these devoted community members. The Oregon Education Association's members have loftier ambitions for Oregon's youth. They're not interested in simply managing to a number. They work every day to help students overcome obstacles, learn new material, build skills, think critically, and find their muses. Many are working wonders in some of the nation's most crowded classrooms. Students come to school with, as you've heard, an increasing array of disabilities, native languages other than English, learning disorders, behavioral issues, and socioeconomic issues that provide challenge. Overall, our state serves greater numbers of students today than ever before. While the expenses for a proper education continue to rise, outpacing inflation, our budgets continue to decline in per-student terms, yet the demand for accountability for outcomes has become louder over time. The trajectories of investment to cost have no longer matched on a parallel track, but have, in fact, crossed somewhere in time. Meanwhile, unfathomably impossible odds face us down in terms of getting 99% of our students to standard by the year 2014, which is what the requirements of NCLB are, or else we face federal sanctions. Something, Mr. Chair and committee members, has got to give. We recognize that the state's funding crisis is based not on a failure of legislative will. Please understand. We understand that. But in a failure of all of us to repair Oregon's broken tax system, as Senator Gordley has eloquently remarked in several previous committee hearings that I've attended. We do not, therefore, come to you today to ask for what it costs to do this education enterprise fully. It's clear that no one in the state is going to be able to find the $7.1 billion recommended by the quality education model to make it possible for 90% of our students to achieve the state-mandated standards. We've come to you instead with what we consider to be not only a modest proposal, but a rather low ambition. To sustain schools at the same service level as you envisioned for them after the failure of ballot measure 30, we call that a maintenance of effort budget at $5.4 billion. To be truthful, some of our friends and advocates in the education community and in the community at large have been pretty disappointed that we've not pushed for more. We understand their reasoning. But we also understand the pressures you face. While we're endeavoring to find a way to resolve the systemic issues facing the state for the long term, we also know that it's going to take time to fix the revenue problem. So in the meanwhile, we're hoping that you will agree that the next generation deserves to know that we won't keep turning up the heat on the frog in the pot. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Sue Lynn Merrick, who I believe is here, and then can Molly Adams come up, and also Rod Boucher from, is there Rod is here? And please start, and please limit your testimony to no more than 3 minutes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to state that the frog boiling in the pot is one of the keenest analogies I've ever seen to what's happening to our funding crisis in Oregon. So thank you, Ms. Winner Whalen.
Okay. Please proceed.
All right. Good morning, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Sue Lyon Myrick. I live in Portland. My senator is Avail Gordley, and my representative is Steve March. I'm also a member of Stand for Children. I'm here to ask you, like many others, to stop the disinvestments in our schools, our communities, and frankly, in our state. While I know that this group faces a difficult task, and I appreciate that the circumstances are not easy, there are things that I believe and hope you will consider when formulating your final decision. I believe you need to realize the true impact upon real children and families like my own. We are just one story, but with an inadequate budget number for K through 12 schools, there will be countless more. I am the mother of two young children. My oldest will be entering kindergarten next fall. Instead of this being a time of excitement when we are able to choose the school best suited for our son and his needs, we are worried. We are having to choose based as much on the many positives Portland Public School District affords as on the negatives. I have spent many hours checking in with principals about the numbers they are estimating for their kindergarten rooms. I stopped asking about whether or not they will have aides. They will not. I worry about whether my son, who is coming from a special education preschool, which has had one teacher, two aides, and part-time physical and speech therapists, into a classroom, which could range from 22, if we are incredibly lucky, to well over 30 children, and just one overstretched teacher, can possibly do well. I am concerned about the impact of budget cuts to both English as a second language and special education services. I worry that ESL students are losing the aids there to help them to learn, and that my son will be losing his ability to focus and to concentrate without an aide helping those students. Our family cannot afford to pay for a private school, and I do not believe that we should have to. I moved to Oregon just over 10 years ago, before my children were born. Back then, I never thought that I would consider leaving Oregon, and I don't want to now. However, I will not allow this state to give my children an inadequate education. If things do not get better soon, my family will have to consider moving somewhere that can support its schools and which is committed to doing so in both good and bad economic times. My family is not alone. Not only families, but I believe also small and large businesses will begin to move out of this state if we cannot make this right. The time to commit to $5.4 billion for the K-12 education budget is now. In order that we can move forward to make Oregon's schools, our communities, and our state strong again. Anything less will mean substantial cuts, such as the equivalent of over 300 teachers in the Portland Public School District, and that's based on a $5.3 billion budget. Anything less than $5.4 billion is not strong leadership when there are ways to get the needed revenue without raising taxes on the average Oregonian.
Are you close to finishing?
Yes. Thank you. Anything less than $5.4 billion is simply not enough. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Molly Adams, and I'm the parent of a seventh grader in the Canby Schools. I've been active in the schools and active on school-related committees for the last 8 years. I'm an organizer for Stand for Children in Canby. We've organized in Canby since December. We currently have 33 members, and we have about 55 on our mailing list. We had a turnout of over 200 people for the school funding rally in Salem. Before my son started kindergarten in 1997, my husband and I researched schools. We had hopes of providing our son with a broad education, including foreign language, liberal arts, in addition to excellent core subjects. We visited private schools and public schools alike. We even interviewed the principal and a kindergarten teacher at Eccles Elementary. Public schools won our hearts. And we were pleased with the small class sizes at the time and the many programs that they offered, including tag, music, even band in the fifth grade. And there was talk about language immersion at that time. The first year was great. The class size was 19 and a full-time aide. But since 1999, our district has sustained $5 million in cuts, $5 million out of a $30 million budget. Those same classes today have 30 students with no aides. Like other districts, our district has reorganized staff, deferred maintenance, eliminated athletic programs, and reduced budgets for textbooks. Our middle school kids are currently being taught out of an out-of-date social studies book. We now have one librarian for the entire district. We have one nurse for 5,500 children. We've obliterated tag. Last year, my son's tag program consisted of 8 students sitting in the hall, teaching themselves. It does not exist. Not only was band eliminated from the fifth grade, but the general music program has been drastically reduced in elementary schools, and my son has yet to learn his first word of a foreign language 8 years later. A few years ago, much time was spent in Oregon developing a quality education model. Quality education is what Oregonians want for our children, not shoestring education. A budget of any less than $5.4 billion will be more cuts to our schools, already deprived of the means of providing programs to enrich our children's education and the dream of a quality education. Our school districts are not spending money on trivialities. There's no fat to cut. Our school board in Canby is already talking about eliminating PE in elementary schools next year if the budget suffers more cuts. It's time to make a choice, music or PE. And it's time for you, our legislature, to make a choice. to fund our schools at a responsible level, $5.4 billion, which would ensure no further cuts to schools. That's the first step back towards the Oregon dream of a quality education for our children. What is holding us back? Only political will.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
$5.4 billion will not assure no further cuts to schools. There are still schools that are going to experience cuts at $5.4 billion. So I hope we all understand that reality.
That's true. In our school district, it would allow us to maintain pretty much what we have, but I know there are other schools.
Absolutely. There are. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Good morning, members of the Ways and Means Committee. My name is Rod Betcher. I'm a school board director from the Centennial School District in Gresham, Oregon. And I'm also the director of financial aid at Mather Community College and a member of a newly formed ad hoc committee of East Multnomah County School Board Directors. I also am on the advisory committee for OSAC, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. My wife is an instructor at Mather Community College. I have three kids who are all in college at this point. My life is education almost at this point at all levels, day and night. In each of these capacities, the work that you do and have done in the past and the decisions that you make directly influence my daily work. They influence the decisions I need to make for students in school, grades kindergarten through 14, as well as forming my opinion of the Oregon school funding system and its effect on Oregon's children and adults at the community college. I've provided the committee with copies of a draft document entitled The State of Affairs in Multnomah County Schools, produced through the efforts of the East Multnomah County group focusing on the Centennial School District's experience, but detailing our collective experience with and without the Multnomah County ITACs and what it has taught us about the appropriate funding levels of schools in Oregon. What we have found is that the K-12 budgets that are being proposed are insufficient to fund an appropriate education for all of the school districts in Oregon. Using the ITACs funding model as a template, which we have found allowed us to operate relatively hold harmless mode for the past 2 years, it would take a state allocation in the biennium of $6 billion just to hold our place educationally with the kids currently in our schools. With all the underfunded requirements of No Child Left Behind, the SIM and CAM requirements, and other proposed unfunded legislative mandates, even the $6 billion will become inadequate and won't be able to produce the kind of educated citizens that Oregon needs to attract businesses. Sure, people will come to the state to settle because of its natural beauty and clean environment, but when they try to get a job, the business community will have turned its back on them because Oregon cannot produce an educated workforce. Few jobs, higher unemployment. That just doesn't seem like an equation for success. In my financial aid office at the community college, I read documents from average students on our campus who rely on financial aid, many getting the Oregon Opportunity Grant, to advance their chances of getting higher paying jobs and securing a brighter future. Most of these students have high school diplomas, and their writing is littered with misspellings, incomplete sentences, and they often are unable to effectively communicate with me. These students will have to rely on developmental education at the community college just to make up for their deficiencies in the underfunded K-12 school system. Does that really make financial sense? It costs more.
Yes. Representative Jensen.
I, too, taught at the community college for a number of years, dating back into the 1960s. We were not in the same type of financial situations at that time, but I found the students that you're describing and the problems that you're describing were present in 1967 as well as in 1990. But I don't think that's necessarily a function of the amount of money that has gone into K-12 education or beyond.
Yeah, mine is pretty broad spectrum. From whom I see both bright and, you know, very poor students as well. As a fellow elected citizen, one of my jobs on a school board is to review budgets for adequacy and legitimacy. If my budgetary experience is similar to other board directors across the state, I can state uncategorically that every stone in the state has been overturned or squeezed to the last drop to make sure these insufficient funds stretch as far as they can. Every parent I talk with at the store wants to know why their dollars don't cover all the basic educational needs of their children. All I can tell them is that we do the best with the money that we've got, that our money, our district has been given. I'm guessing that when you look at a number as large as $5+ billion, you have got to be thinking that it should be enough. But from my experience, it just isn't. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Next party up. I believe I passed Mr. Washburn, who's on the list. Is Mr. Washburn here? Yes, please come forward, along with Marilee McCabe and Sarah Collins. And please limit yourself to 3 minutes. Okay. We have approximately 22 more people to go through in the next hour. So the longer people go beyond the 2.5-3 minutes allotted, the less chance we have to getting to everybody that signed up in this 2 hour allotted time that we have. So please proceed.
My name, shall I begin, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Donald Washburn. I live in Portland. I am a person like everyone else in this room that's interested in the future of our children. I am a business person that has interests in companies all over the world. I am on the board of Stand for Children, Friends of the Children, a number of other organizations that are interested in children's activities. But the speech that basically I sort of penned, I don't have to give. I've heard it all morning from people here. I'm not going to reiterate what people have already said very articulately about the need to attract jobs. And you can't shrink your way out of this problem. This is one that has to be grown out of, because the level of the school funding that we currently have is minimal. Not the one that we look at, but the one we've had. It's minimal because it can't continue to go down. If it continues to go down, we're in some deep hurt. One of the things I do in my life is I travel around the world to different places. And if I can offer a perspective that you might not be getting from other people, let me tell you that in China and India and other places, they're not doing this. They're investing in their children because they know that their children is the only way that they're going to be able to feed billions of people that they have in their countries. They invest in the infrastructure. They invest in technology. Children are going to school 10, 11 months a year. They're learning things. Their school programs, their investment in those is at record levels. They're going up dramatically every year. In fact, in China, if you want to know, they've made a commitment that their higher educational program, which is the only one today that they feel that we have a superior advantage to them, that they believe that within 10 years they'll be at a point where they're at equity with us. And they're putting the money behind that. Young people who used to come over here from those countries and go to our colleges and universities used to stay here. They're starting not to stay here anymore. They're going home. They're going home to teach. They're going home to work. It is an entirely different place than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. I believe that's something we have to really think about. Because our children are going to face that world, not the one we grew up in, but the one that we're in today. They have a need for that. And there's only one way for us to be able to make sure they have that. And that's to give them a fair opportunity to compete in a very challenging world that they're going to confront that we didn't have to confront. After World War II, we had an advantage, and we have had it for a long time, and that advantage is evaporating. And until we realize that and come to grips with it, we will see education as a sort of an expendable, something that can be traded off with other kinds of functions. It is not true. We will truly be dismissing our duty to our children if we don't realize what we must do in this regard. Secondly, the other thing is that economic development is something we talk about. Well, economic development is not something they talk about. It's something they live every day. And it's something that in order for us to be able to grow out of this problem, which I don't believe we can shrink out of, this trade-off is basically saying, hey, you know, our kids will figure out how to catch up because we've always caught up. Well, the point is that in this new world, as they shrink, as we give them less opportunity, as we make less investment and others make a greater investment, that gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And they are not going to make that up on their own. It is only because we will step up now and do what needs to be done in order to fund their future that we will be able to hold our heads high and say, kids, you got a chance. We're going to give you the chance we had. And that's what I ask you to think about. I know you have the courage. I know you have the will. I know you have the desire. But let's exercise the will. Let's say this thing is just too important to back off of. And the place you start is by not going lower, but drawing a line and say, from here we're going to bounce back up. And we're not only going to fund the schools, but we're going to figure out how to grow our economy so they got someplace to go. And businesses will only come in here if they think that we're really committed to that. You'll get a few, but you're not going to get anybody of any substance to come in here unless they believe that this state has the will to do this. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Merrily McCabe, and I'm a member of the Salem-Keizer chapter of Stand for Children. I'm here today to urge you to, as you've heard from other people, continue funding at the inadequate level of $5.4 billion for our schools. I'm going to speak to you from four different perspectives, sort of four hats that I wear. The first is as a member of the Salem-Keizer citizen-appointed, citizen committee, which is called a budget advisory team. Another perspective I'll be speaking from is the my position as a volunteer in a local elementary school, which is a high-poverty bilingual school. I'll thirdly be speaking from my perspective as a neighbor to parent of a very young child. And lastly, and I'm going to do all this very quickly, too. You'll be happy to know. And lastly, as chair of the Polk County Commission for Children and Families. First, my experience on the budget advisory team. I've been on that for 2 years now, and we've spent our time looking for ways that our school district, the Salem-Keizer School District, could save money to put more money into the classroom. What we've found instead is there is not a spare dollar to be had in the district. What we're finding is that district properties are disintegrating, literally crumbling. Administrative positions, central administrative positions, have been cut so to such an extreme that there's inadequate central support for academic programs. And that inadequacy at the central administrative level goes to such a despairing level that there aren't people able to do the functions of their jobs because they have too many jobs to do. And lastly, in a desperate search for dollars, our schools are selling foods and drinks, which, as you all no doubt know, are completely unhealthy for our children to consume, but it's a way to raise money at the individual school level. In the school where I volunteer, it's Bush Elementary School, within a stone's throw of here, I've been working with one boy, now a fourth grader, for several years, and I'm in his classroom regularly, as I have been in his previous classrooms. This year he has one of the best teachers in the school, but he's in a big classroom. He's in a classroom with bilingual kids, so the teacher's teaching in two languages and trying to bring kids who come from other countries and even lesser schooling than what our own kids have received here. And worse yet, there's the behaviorally challenged kids that you've heard others speak of today who are constant disruption in the classroom, making it difficult for her to teach. There's no teacher in that building who is not facing the combined challenge of high poverty students and children with severe behavioral problems. And The solution in part is smaller classes, but we also need the social services to support the teachers who are dealing with these incredible behavioral and other medical problems that kids come to school with.
Please close.
Pardon?
Please close in the next few seconds, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Neighbor with 35, whose first grade kid has 35 kids in her class. 35 kids in a first grade classroom. That's unconscionable. And lastly, from my perspective with the Polk County Commission for Children and Families, I'd like to say that it's not wise dollars spent to cut from other social service programs to fund schools. And so I ask you not to go that route. Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. My name is Sarah Colling, and I am a student at Willamette University, a member of Stanford Children, and a voter in Jackie Winter's district. The budgets proposed fall short of the $5.4 billion needed to maintain current class sizes and educational programs. This just seems penny-wise and pound-foolish to force districts to increase class size at a time when there is a national movement to increase educational standards. I grew up in California, and when I entered high school, there was a policy to limit our freshman and English math classes to 20 students. This allowed the teachers to be less stressed, able to utilize a more hands-on curriculum. They were not wasting time keeping the class in order. Students received more one-on-one attention, etc. By the time I was a senior, my English class was back up to 37 students, and it took a while for the teacher to even know our names. There is a significantly less incentive to do well in an environment like that. It's not fair to ask any student, let alone an elementary school student, to have to face up to this challenge. Class sizes here in Oregon are already the second highest in the nation, and much bigger than 20 students. I recognize that the members of this committee are often put in the tough situation of choosing between funding education and other important social services. But this is a false choice. There are a number of reasonable revenue options in the House Revenue Committee and savings to be found in the prison's budget. If the responsible amount, $5.4 billion, is not allotted to education, all of Oregon's school children will suffer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Val Rylands, Sarah Liebman, and Lori Hoskins. And on deck, Andy Jordan, Don Bender, and Chris Anderson. Please proceed.
Chairman Devin, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Lori Hoskins. I will save just reading my testimony and highlight some of the personal points on behalf of the North Clackamas School District that I am representing today. I'm a concerned parent, a Stanford Children member, obviously, a very active volunteer, and a PTO board member. I, too, am very worried and appalled of not hitting our $5.4 billion mark for school funding to simply maintain. I'm very proud of the North Clackamas School District and the achievements that both my children and the children of North Clackamas have continued to make. And in my written testimony, I've outlined a lot of the scores, the proficiency in reading, math, science. Despite the cuts of the last 5 years, North Clackamas has continued to make gains. Our high schools have been doing very well despite some very, very strong cuts last year. My concern going into this year is anything less than $5.4 billion makes us have to cut yet again, another time. And having already cut in North Clackamas to the bare bones, the only thing left to cut are teachers, which of course affects class sizes and school days. My school, elementary school, where both my first grader and my fourth grade boys attend, we have no library this year. Our PTO at this time of the year, approximately March and April, begins to buy paper for the school. We are 100% out of our supply budget at this point, which we're glad the PTO has money to do that, but it's a little scary. My fourth grader, who is a high-functioning autistic mainstream child, has 26 kids in his classroom this year, which is actually considered a blessing considering some of the other class sizes. But he, along with the other seven children in his class who are on individual education programs, already are vying for the teacher's attention and having a very difficult time getting the help they need to simply maintain and move forward in their classroom. Looking at larger than, 26, 32, now that was talking about 37 kids in the class, you're also talking about teachers having to do combined classrooms. there is a very rare instance where one grade would fit into that type of model. And when you, and I, every one of the teachers at Ardenwald came to me knowing I was coming here and said, you know, it's so difficult for them. They already have no planning periods because all their planning periods have been taken away from the electives. And to have to, you know, have a third grade teacher who's taught for, our average teacher's taught for 26 years in the school, all of a sudden have to learn second grade curriculum or first grade curriculum. And if you've got a half and half class, what do you do with the kids? If you're teaching second grade, what do you do with the third graders if you don't have an assistant? We are a Title I school, and even our classrooms, you know, with the federal funding, we do not have an assistant in every classroom. We have a couple hours a day if a teacher is lucky. So it really puts a huge burden on our teachers to try to get this quality education that everybody else has been testifying for. So I will, again, not go through all the rest of the details, but I just hope that my personal stories can kind of put a face on this when you guys are helping to make this very, very important decision for our children.
Sarah, before you proceed, thank you very much. Sarah, is there a Val Rylands here? Okay. I called him up. He didn't come up, so please proceed.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. My name is Sarah Liebman, and I am a student teacher and a master's student at Portland State University. I have been student teaching at Harriet Tubman Middle School and Lincoln High School. Today I'm going to talk a little bit more about Lincoln High School, although these problems are widespread throughout the district and throughout the state. At Lincoln High School, my fourth period class has 48 students in it. 48 students. Okay? I was surprised by that, and I did a little hunting around, found out that, that Oregon actually has class sizes that are 30% higher than the rest of the country, which is hardly a selling point for businesses when they're looking about, thinking about where to go, where to move, where to hire people. So I thought that what we needed in this state was to think about how, where our budgets are coming from. So I actually assigned my sophomore and junior economics students to balance the state budget. Senator Devlin was kind enough to join us last semester. I have actually a new crop of economics students this semester, some very interesting plans, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I've been hearing from my students. My students this semester do not want to cut the Oregon Health Plan. They do not want to cut programs for the seniors or the disabled. They do not want to cut, well, there's some discussion of cutting prisons. That's sort of, different groups are doing different things about that. But only one group is really looking at that with any seriousness. As I say, the plans are still in the planning stages. I've just been listening to different groups as they discuss. What I am hearing from my students is every single group would like to raise taxes, and they have specific plans of how they want to do that. Cigarette taxes, beer and wine taxes are quite popular among my students. They also, and they point out that these would also perhaps decrease the number of people using those substances, reducing caseloads for mental health and other services. They also have talked about working with the Lottery Commission, $65 million, folks. That's one additional student in every elementary classroom in the state. Okay? I want that number to mean something to you. And that number is becoming a subsidy for beer and wine and tavern owners. And this is not a state subsidy for tavern owners. This is supposed to be for the public good, constitutionally mandated. Another very popular option is students would like to tax foreign income of Oregon subsidiaries. Basically, we're giving businesses an incentive to move their jobs to other countries. And that's $28 million, right? That's a school day here in Oregon. Corporate minimum tax, which is actually supported by the Oregon Business Association, is another thing some students have been talking about. And many students would like added revenue because they want to establish a rainy day fund. I have one more point. Okay. The last one is students are very, very interested. I think 5 out of 6 groups have looked at implementing a value-added tax like Washington. Very interesting idea, and I don't have time to discuss it further, but I encourage you to consider it as 5 out of 6 of my student groups did. Thanks so much. Pay now or pay later.
Thank you. Andy, thank you very much. Andy Jordan, Don Bender, and Chris Anderson. And parties, because we only have about 40 minutes left, please limit your testimony to no more than about 2 minutes each.
My name is Andy Jordan, and I'm here representing the Oregon PTA. Oregon PTA is the largest and oldest child advocacy organization in the state. We have 23,000 members across the state. I'm here also as a parent. I have three kids, but we are advocating, our organization advocates for the 550,000 school children of Oregon. We are one of the organizations that is terribly depressed by this 5.4 number. The thought of not all schools and school districts remaining whole troubles us dearly. And I know that you've heard from, I know that we're sending this building 1,000 emails a week, so I know that you're hearing from us. I wanted to comment on, we were very involved with Measure 30 because we were very involved in the last budget number for the biennium. And our belief is that the voters said no to that plan. The voters, I think I told you very loud and clearly that we are so dependent on income taxes, and I think that's what they were saying. I think they were not saying no to new taxes. We want to make sure that you look at other revenue options and that you take it into all of those as account as well. We also want you to know that Oregon PTA isn't here just complaining. We are also trying to take action with our own members, and we are doing something called Taking Action Together, and we are having diverse, geographically diverse PTAs meet together to talk about what they want in their schools, and we know that they all want great schools, and we all know that basics are not reading, writing, and arithmetic. So you'll hear from more members, so I'll stop
there. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Chris Anderson. My children attend Irvington Elementary School in Portland, which has 500 students, 50% of which are minority, 35% of which qualify for free and reduced price lunches. My oldest child entered school in 2002. It was my first time in schools since I was a student in the 1970s. I was surprised to learn that Portland has over 100 schools, but only two people on staff to mow the lawns. I don't remember my parents ever mowing the lawn of my school. I was surprised that the class supply list includes soap and Kleenex. When I was a student, it was pencils and erasers. And there were more surprises. That year, we lost our librarian, our music teacher. Our teachers worked 10 days without pay so that our children could have a full school year. And our PTA increased its fundraising from $15,000 a year to $50,000. And each year since then, we have lost more, and our PTA now raises $100,000 a year. Tuesday night, we learned that we will be losing almost 25% of our staff next year. Next year, parents will be running the library. Parents will be covering playground duty and lunch duty because there will no longer be enough adult bodies on staff to cover those responsibilities. Parents will staff the copy room. And parents will be in classrooms continuously because it is very hard for one teacher without educational assistance to teach 28 six-year-olds to read, 28 eight-year-olds to creatively problem solve, or 28 10-year-olds to think critically. And we expect to see toilet paper on the class supply list. I also had the frog anecdote in mind, and I too am tired of being treated like a frog. But I have some suggestions. Our schools do need at least $5.4 billion this biennium. This will not hold Portland, you know, harmless. We will still face cuts. But we do not want you to reach $5.4 billion by cutting the Oregon Health Plan or by forcing seniors out of their homes. I want you to increase the corporate minimum income tax to at least $500, preferably $3,000 based on gross revenue. I know the business lobby is loud, but poor public schools are far more likely to drive businesses out of Oregon than $500 a year. I want you to reduce lottery commissions to 20% because thriving schools are much more important to Oregon than thriving taverns and gambling outlets. And I want you to limit the mortgage interest deduction to $20,000
We should be subsidizing our children's educations, not vacation homes and luxury homes. And I also wanted to say that I was the person that raised my hand to support the dedicated sales tax and raised my hand against the dedicated sales tax, and I just wanted to clarify that quickly. I oppose the sales a dedicated sales tax because it would be unacceptably regressive and because I don't think you can pass that here in Oregon without reducing the income tax, and that's just moving taxes around. I would support a dedicated sales tax if it was a tax on services only. As someone said the other night, the rich or the poor buy a can of Raid. The rich hire an exterminator. And I think that a tax on services would be far less regressive, and it would truly need to be a new tax. I am happy to pay more taxes for education. I don't want it to just replace income taxes. What I really want is for you, as our elected leaders, to start seeing the possibilities instead of seeing only the limitations. Please find at least $5.4 billion for our schools.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, committee members, good morning. My name is Dawn Bonder. I'm here before you today representing the Oregon Business Association. Oregon Business Association is comprised of 250 member companies, large and small, and statewide. The board of directors of OBA is comprised of successful business people who want businesses to thrive in Oregon. They know there is a direct link between the quality of essential services that the state provides to its citizens and a successful state economy. This link is particularly strong with respect to our state education system. Without a quality education system, we will not thrive economically in Oregon. It is that simple. It is this fact that led OBA to declare public education its top priority for the 05-07 biennium, and we strongly urge the legislature and governor to do so as well. OBA urges the legislature to make the choices necessary to fund state pre-K at a level which will allow at least the same percentage of eligible children to be served during 05-07 as we were able to serve in 03-05. We also urge you to achieve K-12 funding at a level that allows school districts to maintain the level of student-teacher contact and learning attained in the 03-05 biennium. It is absolutely critical that the legislature prevent any further erosion to Oregon's pre-K program and K-12 schools. Oregon's public schools have been mocked nationally and internationally, and it is no wonder that our state is burdened with the stigma of being in an education crisis. We need to understand that this dark shadow over our education system is also a weight around the necks of businesses in our state. Our schools are not doing the best possible job in preparing our children for the workforce and college. Businesses are reporting that they're having difficulty finding qualified employees from the available pool in Oregon. Colleges are reporting that students increasingly need remedial coursework in order to progress in their studies. OBA member company executives have experienced difficulty persuading job candidates to take high-level, high-salaried positions with their companies because these potential employees do not want to move their families to Oregon, and they cite the public schools as the reason why. Bottom line, if we can't draw new employees to our state, we have absolutely no hope of attracting new businesses. Without healthy businesses and qualified employees, we cannot expect our economy to thrive. And for a state that's overly dependent upon income tax revenues, this is an especially troubling scenario. While a strong public education system is good for business, Oregon Business Association also recognizes that our children are the key to long-term viability in our state. Imagine what your job would be like if Oregon's human service demands and incarceration demands required less money. If we could reduce the human services budget and corrections budget, the $12.393 billion you have to allocate would provide much more for schools and other infrastructure needs. One conservative estimate averages says that the average cost of incarcerating a juvenile for 1 year is approximately $34,000, and that's a conservative estimate. Some go as high as $64,000 a year. The more dollars we spend on those in poverty, without health insurance, or in the Oregon Penitentiary, the fewer dollars we can invest in our state. By decreasing the number of people living in poverty or incarcerated, we free up vast amounts of dollars for investment in Oregon. There is no better way to decrease those numbers than education. It's been clearly demonstrated that children who attend quality early education programs as 3- and 4-year-olds are better prepared and more successful when they enter kindergarten. Research indicates that every dollar invested in a Head Start program results in $9 in benefits. These benefits include increased earnings, employment and family stability, and also include decreased welfare dependency, crime costs, grade repetition, and special education.
Could you please close?
Sure. It's indisputable that our elementary and secondary education system will also provide a much needed investment for our state. As Oregonians and concerned business leaders, the members of the OBA Board of Directors sympathize with your difficult choices, and we ask you to please look at some of the suggestions OBA has put forth for increasing revenue and decreasing expenses. OBA believes that there are ways to improve the budget outlook and ways to increase dollars that are being dedicated to pre-K and K-12. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, quickly, the OBA, do they support a sales tax dedicated to education? Is that one of the recommendations?
That is not one of the recommendations in our legislative agenda for this year. Our board has not taken a position on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
I just want to be very clear that when I speak of a sales tax dedicated to education, I mean it as a part of overall tax reform restructuring in the state and not a regressive tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're quite welcome. Catherine Firestone, Ruth Atkins, and Marcelo Natilo. I probably did a terrible job on that name, but apologize. And on deck, Peter Trumba, Beth Girott, and Lori Vischer. And please limit yourselves to 2 minutes.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. I'm Catherine Firestone, Executive Director of the Coalition for Schools. My job is to make sure that we're doing more than just talking about the problems our schools face. I've been reminded of the old cartoon, the one where the sheep, the wolf, and the sheepdog all show up to work, punch the time clock, say, "Good morning, Sam," and proceed to go about the business at hand, where they play villain and victim until the day's end, and they punch out, say, "See you tomorrow," and go home. It sums up too closely the school funding debate here in Salem. Here we are years later, still discussing the same old, same old. We have villains and victims, hearings and pseudo-debates. We show up for work day after day, year after year, with little to no real expectation that anything about the business at hand will change. We talk about the right number, dollars to the classroom, and toss out alphabet soup like NCLB, ADMW, and SimCam QEM. Depending on whose side you're on, we lament that we're not meeting goals or the goals are too high, that teachers are overpaid or overworked, we're top-heavy on administrators or they're not doing their jobs, parents are not involved or too involved, and our kids can't read or we don't have the staff to teach them or we teach to the test or our test scores aren't good enough. We discuss assessment and outcomes and seat time and formula. My concern is that we've all become so accomplished at our roles that we never vary from our scripted lines, and perhaps we are missing a central character. As you prepare to make a recommendation to Ways and Means, I would ask you to consider some first-hand research in the interest of delivering the best possible performance for those you were elected to serve. Go observe in a classroom in your district for a full day. Ask to be assigned a student. Spend a day with a bird's eye view of their world. Take the opportunity to bring more realism to the role that you play in this particular theater. It is truly up to you to bring our students to center stage and ensure that they are the focus upon which decisions are made. In the meantime, schools will open, teachers will teach, administrators will look for savings, parents will fill in the gap where they can, and students will attend. As lawmakers, you have an opportunity and an obligation to make the debate and what happens in our public schools truly meaningful. Jen Cool, a teacher in Hillsborough, is quoted in last Sunday's Oregonian saying, "You can't be haphazard. As educators, you're not dealing with a project, you're dealing with human beings." Personally, since I entered into this forum and debate on public education, my children both entered into and graduated from public schools. Another generation of Oregon students awaits your interpretation of the role they will play in the future. Thank you
very much. Please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Ruth Adkins. I'm the PTA president at Robert Gray Middle School in Southwest Portland. I've been fighting for adequate school funding since 1996, when the first of my three children entered the public schools. Every 2 years, I think that surely this is the year that the governor and the legislature is going to finally show some guts and some leadership and reform our bizarre tax system so that our schools are properly funded. Surely our elected officials understand that investing in quality schools will pay off in a stronger economy and greater quality of life for all Oregonians. Surely elected officials won't get away with underfunding public education while giving lip service to how much they support children. And every 2 years, I am bitterly disappointed. And my outrage and my fury keeps growing. At our last Robert Gray Middle School PTA meeting, we had to talk about where to cut 3 out of 27 teachers next year. Should it be art or music or library, Spanish or maybe science? These are not choices that principals should have to be making. Our PTA fundraises for books, tables, computers, other equipment, right on down to the Kleenex and the other things that people have talked about. We provide aid for students whose families are struggling with poverty, everything from backpacks to clean socks to after-school tutoring and snacks for the hungry children. We are one of the lucky schools where parents can afford to raise some money, but we cannot fundraise enough to replace teachers or provide a full school year. That is the responsibility of the state. And I refuse to engage in the bickering over 5.175 or 375 when we all know very well that a quality education for all children costs not 5.4, not 6.4, but $7 billion. In Portland, anything less than 6 will mean yet more cuts. For shame. How dare the governor and the legislature tell me that Oregon can't afford to provide a quality education for all our children? When big corporations get away with paying only $10 in taxes, when hundreds of tax loopholes are giving my tax dollars to obscure business sectors, owners of vacation homes, and other special interests. And when an excessive commission rate is subsidizing failing taverns who are addicted to the lottery money that should be going to our schools. You must seek additional revenue from corporations and close the wasteful tax loopholes so that the budget can be substantially increased and we can maintain a full school year and reasonable class sizes. Again, as a PTA mom, as a citizen, and as a voter, it is morally wrong to not adequately fund our schools. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Marcello John Napolitano. I'm a parent of a six-year-old who's in first grade in Hillsborough. My wife and I both volunteer in our kids' school. My wife every week reads group to groups in her class. So we have a first-hand look at the struggle that some of the kids, especially kids that don't come from families that don't speak English and families that are low income and where maybe a single parent has to work two jobs and they just don't have the bandwidth to help their kids learn to read. And we can see the big gap that is growing between those kids that are sharp, they're very motivated, but they need more attention from their teachers and the rest of their class. I have a written testimony. I'm just going to touch on a few points on what the proposed budget means in Hillsborough. We have 23 elementary schools. Each one of those will lose one teacher in the next biennium at the proposed level. And of course, that impacts more those kids that need it, need more contact with teachers. We have been, for the last 2 years, we've been spending as little as possible in anything that's not classroom related. We're way behind on even adoption of books for high school. We're 3 years behind. We will be 5 years behind if the budget stays at the levels that have been proposed. We're behind on maintenance, on a lot of things that eventually we'll have to pay and pay more because we're not paying enough now. We're spending out of our ending fund balance to levels that, you know, we can't do it for very long. This is should be temporary. And long term, I urge you to come up with some good solutions for the long term for our schools. And I'm glad to hear that there are some ideas going through, and I hope that you'll have the courage to come up with something that we can vote on. Thank you
very much. Peter Trumba, Beth Giroux, and Lori Vischer. And please limit yourself to no more than 2 minutes and hopefully less. We have about 10 more to go through after this.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and honorable members of the subcommittee. My name is Peter Tromba. I'm a school principal in Eugene, Oregon at North Eugene High School. Been involved in education for 17 years in 3 regions of the country, public and private. Our philosophy at North Eugene is public education is a generator for lasting democratic society and economically secure future. We've got problems at North Eugene, and in recognition of that, we have undertaken a process with a significant funding from the Oregon Small Schools Initiative to change our school structure significantly to provide for better success for all students, college readiness, and close our achievement gap. As a result of having over $1 million, we've had the luck to visit all kinds of states across the country who are undergoing similar reform with similar ideals. I've personally visited a school in Boston, at Boston Arts Academy, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Tacoma, Washington. These schools are incredible. Many of them are graduating 98% of their students and getting 94 or above percent of their students into college. Some of these schools that are getting 94% into college include students who all entered with English as a second language and low proficiency in English. These are numbers that no school in Oregon can touch, including the best of the schools in Oregon. And the punchline of all of our visits when we go and see all these wonderful schools across the country to learn from is the huge disparity in services between Oregon schools and the schools everywhere else we have visited in numerous states across the country, both our neighboring states and states all the way to the East Coast. People sometimes laugh at the things that I say or our staff members say regarding the number of teachers, counselors, or administrators or other support services in our schools. And similar to the gentleman who gave the perspective of other countries leading ahead of Oregon and therefore taking jobs and economic status from us, the same is true of our states and the country. In a similar school to North Eugene, and located in Washington State, the school had twice as many counselors, more than twice as many special education teachers, and an extra administrator, as well as a higher staffing ratio. This difference will undoubtedly slow, inhibit, and derail similar school efforts in Oregon. That's my last paragraph. It's already happening up in a school in Portland at Marshall. The chief reason our staff and our district are struggling with the change is the lack of an uncertainty of school funding. And we've got business investing millions of dollars in Oregon, and we're not able to make up the same level of support that other states are. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Okay, Chair Devlin and honorable members of the subcommittee, I'm Beth Giroux, Chair of the Eugene School Board. The Eugene School District serves about 18,000 students and is recognized for student achievement, innovation, and strong community support for our schools. Our community is alarmed at what it sees happening to our schools. Local voters have passed 2 levies, a school district local option and a city levy, to support our schools. Other districts around the state view us as well off due to this local support. Still, our district has made significant cuts despite our local option, our local tax levies. Since 2001-02, we have cut 109 positions, 89 due to state funding levels, and an additional 20 positions due to declining enrollment. Shifting funding for 66 full-time positions to a city levy and funded all athletic programs and student activities with city funds. increased class sizes. We now have elementary school classrooms with 30 students and high school classes such as physics and algebra with more than 40 students. And we've closed 5 elementary school sites to reduce non-instructional costs. Our student population is changing, reflecting trends across our state. This challenges our schools and teachers as they try to address a wide range of abilities and meet the needs of every student. We are serving more English language learners and students from different cultures, more students from low-income families. These families cannot afford after-school enrichment activities, tutoring, or counseling if a student is struggling, or even medical care. They rely on our schools for help. More high-needs special education students. Eugene has a growing number of students with autism. Many of these students are served in our regular classrooms because they function at a high level academically, but they require one-on-one adult attention due to their behavioral challenges. This is expensive, and our costs are growing. This year, we are serving 109 students who require services that cost the district more than $25,000. Our principals struggle each year with trade-offs. Under either the House or the Senate budget proposal for 2005-07, our schools will not be adequately funded. Under both budget proposals, our district will spend one-time money to try to preserve school programs and close the achievement gap in student performance over the next biennium. This is not a sustainable strategy. As you build a state budget for schools in 2005-07, I encourage you to be forthright with Oregonians about the state of our public schools. Our students are not well served at the current funding level. Let's be clear about that. Our schools are struggling to meet the needs of a wide range of learners. We are focused on improving student achievement, but we have reduced our schools to bare-bones programs. We cannot deliver the well-rounded education that our students deserve and Oregonians expect within the budgets that are proposed. Strong public schools and well-educated students are essential to our economic and civic future.
Could you please close?
Yes. We need stable funding that restores and strengthens our schools.
Thank you. Please proceed.
My name is Laurie Vischer. I'm a member of Stanford Children. I'm a minister of a 750-member Presbyterian church in Portland, some of whom are here today. I'm also a wife and a mother to Aaron, who's 3, and Alexander, who's 6. I'm here to testify because I know firsthand the damage being done our schools as we continue to divest from the schools. If the K-12 budget is funded at less than $5.4 billion, you've heard there will be more cuts. Our son Alex is in first grade at Alameda School. Alameda is a 650-student population K-5th grade. This school is gifted with very committed parents who have the resources to fund Alameda Foundation and to volunteer many hours in the school. We also have caring, creative, and frugal teachers, an excellent principal and vice principal. I have been inspired as I've seen my son and his classmates move from not reading to reading fluently, even with very diverse levels at the beginning. But Superintendent Vicki Phillips released a budget plan proposed on the governor's education funding report for 2005 for the K-12. In Portland Public Schools, that proposal will eliminate 335 full-time school positions. For Alameda School, that translates to the loss of 2.5 positions. As you've heard, and I hear my congregation, parents and teachers I know are facing greater cuts than that. We have one PE teacher for 650 students at Alameda. Her position may well be cut. Does that make sense with current concerns about childhood obesity? There is no fat in the school budget. When parents shop for back-to-school items, we do buy copy paper for the machines. Please. Funding for schools is not what it was when we were children or when our kids were in school. Worst of all, we are feeling great discouragement that every year we phone for money, we rally for schools, we have school auctions, and we still see that our class sizes are growing and school days may be shorter. I'm almost finished. I just want to say, as a minister, I'm well aware of the needs for seniors and other social services, but I don't accept that we have to choose between supporting children's adequate education and services for seniors. Children can't vote, but their interests and ours in the state are at stake. So please help us to be responsible to fund at $5.4 billion. Thank you.
Kathy Cook, Virginia Feldman, Victoria, a name that I cannot pronounce. Please come forward. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to limit you each to about a minute and a half, no more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Kathy Cook, and I'm a member of Stanford Children. I'm a parent of two children who attend Irvington Elementary, and we are one of those schools that will still suffer cuts, even if you fund us at $5.4 billion. I have a short story about the terrible choice our principal made this past Tuesday night. In order to spare our second through fifth grade classes from suffering class sizes of over 35 children, she made the gut-wrenching choice of cutting off our free full-day kindergarten to only neighborhood families. And remember, as my counterpart Chris Anderson mentioned, we have a 50% minority population, and many of our transfer families happen to be low income. We are putting in place a school structure that will essentially support only the wealthy, those who can afford high housing costs in an affluent neighborhood like Irvington, and excluding the families who barely subsist above poverty line. So I'm speaking to you today because I'm constantly talking to my own representative, Chip Shields, my Senator Margaret Carter. They are hearing from me ad nauseum. I'm so grateful to tell you all that I really need you to talk to your colleagues across the political divide and tell them that it's a watershed moment for protecting our kids and being leaders. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Respected legislators, I am Dr. Jeannie Feldman, a pediatrician who worked in North Portland for 30 years. One of the reasons I retired last year was it was increasingly impossible to help my child patients attain the opportunity they deserved as Americans due to the falling quality of public education. As class size increases, as schools decreased, school year decreased, marginal kids, minority kids, all of who struggled to reach that great American dream, had even fewer chances. Teachers overwhelmed with larger class size and numbers sent their kids in for the chemical cure. More and more they came to me for attention deficit disorder evaluations. Please give them Ritalin or something. The problem of most of these kids was not ADD or attention, their own attention. It was the lack of attention from their teachers. Give them not Ritalin, but teachers, please. Studies show very clearly that school failure leads to more juvenile delinquency and crime. We shoot ourselves in the foot by decreasing school funding because we end up needing more prisons. Abused kids, too, need more help. They cost the state a lot of money from expensive drugs and psychotherapy. I headed the child abuse team at Kaiser for 20 years. The two strongest factors for resiliency in kids, that backup, that bounce back, is number one, participation in the arts, and we saw that in the Oregonian this morning about how Iraqi veterans have come over their post-traumatic stress syndrome through drama, and the presence of a trusted counselor in their daily environment. Both of these resources have become decreasingly available from our budget cuts in the past. Incidentally, Senator Devlin, I'm in your district and Southwest Portland, and over the last 20 years, my own kids in public schools have seen this remarkable fall in their what they can provide. In the 60s, I attended Chicago Public Schools. At that time, we were the laughing stock for school funding. We now know what state is the laughing stock. Please don't cut further.
Please proceed. And before you proceed, could Margot Preston, Marge Gale, Frances Charbonnet, and Louise Curran all be prepared to come up very quickly? Please.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. My name is Victoria Guillebeau. I'm the Region 2 Director for Oregon PTA, the state's oldest and largest child advocacy organization.
I'm here today representing the over 9,000 PTA members in Portland Public Schools. More importantly, I am here as the appalled parent of a 13-year-old son. Portland parents have long and tirelessly worked to plug the holes in our kids' education that, beginning with Measure 5, have been hacked out of the PPS budget. Unfortunately, despite our best efforts, this year's budget looks like that instead of the usual acts we face every year, it's more like an Al-Qaeda car bomb has hit our district. In Portland next year, we are closing 5 schools. We are losing 261 teachers. Class sizes are going to be huge, and we were told that this is the best case scenario. This is not acceptable. Now, it's not that Portland parents are doing anything less for their children's school. Last year alone, PTA parents in Portland raised over $2,437,000 for schools. Those are PTA budgets, and those went directly to programs for kids. That's an average of $92,000 per school. I also know that Portland parents aren't the only ones. Parents across this state are doing the same thing. I know parents who spend a huge amount of their volunteer time fundraising or planning fundraisers. It's still not enough. Private money cannot fund public education. Not equitably. Sort of like the passengers on the Titanic. The kids in affluent communities may be knee-deep in water, but the kids in poor communities in steerage are drowning. It shouldn't be that way.
If you could please close.
Okay. I don't know of a single member of the Oregon legislature who campaigned on a platform of cutting education. Every one of you that I heard claimed to be education's friend. I am here on behalf of my son to collect that promissory note. Do the right thing, folks. Do what you promised us when you were running.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please hold it down. Marge Preston, Marge Gale, Francis Charbonnet, and Louise Curran. And that will be our final testimony. I'll ask staff. Two parties were still signed up, but they are not here, no longer here in the audience, but they are both lobbyists in the building, John McCauley and Don Schoenberg, and we'll ask them to submit written testimony to the...
Can I have Deborah Lopardo?
We signed them both.
Okay. They'll all have about a minute each because we will be closing at about 10:31. Please proceed. Yes.
Me. Hello, Chair Devlin. It is really good to see, or usually seeing, most of the time we've seen most of the committee. I think that that's what the parents of the state deserved and should have received, so I'm glad that happened.
Ms. Lopardo, please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Deborah Lopardo. I'm a Lake Oswego mom and volunteer in the schools. I'm a little cranky at being here again. I have been here off and on for years begging for my state leaders to help my public, treat my public education fairly. And here I am again, so I'm cranky. We all know Measure 5 put financial control in your hands, but it's also put governance control in your hands. As you've heard, and I can repeat what all these parents said, we've cut custodians, librarians, administrators. Our teachers took 5 days of salary cut and left the building. If you do not have this settled well, I hope you can all take 5 to 10 days of no salary, stay here and work for our kids too. In Lake Oswego, we've taken cuts, but we have also stepped up. We have just passed our second local option tax, and we have an informal tax in that most of our parents pay pretty well to our foundation, and still we take cuts. So since you have assumed our governance control, tell us, what should we do? Cut electives, make class sizes larger, charge our sports families even more? Now they pay about $200 a sport for their child to participate. Should we drop our PE and music instructors so the classroom teachers can take on and let us know. I'd love to have an email on that. Since your choice has been to underfund in education, let us know. Someone in Salem must know that you're not offering the schools much. You've offered them an accrual strategy. Basically, please use a credit card strategy to get through your school years, and that comes from Salem. I look at legislative sessions by speakers. I clearly remember Speaker Snodgrass became a highly unpopular leader with parents and eventually with voters, as she showed no sympathy or help. Now we're beginning to see Speaker Minnis take on that same mantle of anti-child, anti-school, anti-local control. Maybe that'll have a meeting for the future.
If you could please close.
Thank you very much.
Next. Sorry about having to do this, but we...
good morning, Senator Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Louise Curran. I'm Executive Vice President of AFG Oregon and Principal Secretary at East Sylvan Middle School in Portland. I'm submitting written testimony. In my written testimony, I have addressed many things that other people have said today, so I won't waste your time saying those things again, but I will say that on behalf of classified employees in all of the state of Oregon, which our organization represents, we do hope that you will carefully consider a 5.3 budget. We know this is not adequate and stable funding, but this is at least a start. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Please proceed.
My name is Francis Charbonnier. I've been on the McMinnville School Board for 24 years and on the OSBA Board for 6 years. And I appreciate your attention. I realize you have a very difficult job, and I want to focus on what is an adequate and achievable state school fund figure for the coming biennium. And initially, the governor proposed $5 billion in a budget that had a 2% increase on K-12 and a 37% increase on corrections. And frankly, even though I realize there are needs in corrections, the stark difference between those two numbers is appalling. Now then, we got good news on revenue forecasts, and now we seem to be converging on better figures. The governor is at 525. One side of the aisle is on 5175 and said that they think there'd be minimal cuts. The other side says, well, we hope to get 5325, and with this, I think we should be doing okay. I want to assure you that if you're looking at the depressed state fund that we have this year, this biennium at 4.9, and if you look at increases in enrollment, increases in inflation, which is starting to rise up again, and mostly the disproportionate impact on schools of the increase in the per employer rate. And those things bring us, especially the decision of the Supreme Court, to $5.45 billion as a figure that corresponds to the 4.9 on maintaining services. Obviously, we can achieve that, but I hope that you can find in your hearts and in your deliberations to reach for at least 5.3 million. I think any number lower than that is going to be further declined in the state, part of the state of education in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Speaker Minnis has entered and has asked to speak to the committee briefly. So if the speaker would please come forward, I will hold the committee here for a few more minutes. Please come forward, Speaker Minnis.
That's 3 minutes.
Speaker Minnis, welcome to the Subcommittee on Education.
Thank you, and I thank you for the committee's indulgence. I'd like to say that I couldn't agree with these parents more. I am tired of this debate. I'm tired of kids having to come to Salem and beg for funding every 2 years in this building. I've been in this building for 20 years, and this debate has gone on for 20 years, and it's long enough. I proposed a plan that would dedicate long-term, stable funding for the kids in this state. 50% of the personal income tax that will allow our kids to go to school without wondering every 2 years whether or not they're going to have money to go to school. And I would just like to put this out there. I would like to dedicate a stable, steady fund for our children so they don't have to be loaded up in buses, parents don't have to take time off work and come down to Salem and beg us to fund education in the state. K through 12 is the most important thing we do, educating our children. And it's time that we step back and look at how we do this process. Setting aside 50% of the state income tax would guarantee our children's education from here on in. People have talked about ceilings, they've talked about floors, but I believe it would allow schools to plan long-term. They would know that when they come in every 2 years, that there is a certain amount of dollars that they can plan to fund their schools, to fund their education. It's not just the 8% floor. There's also money that would, if it comes in over the 8%, they can be fed directly into classrooms. It's to help underperforming schools, and it'll also help incentivize schools that do well. It's an extra pot of cash. 8% is the floor. And then also, we have a rainy day fund that's in that plan that will help assure that when we have a downturn, we don't have to have school days cut. We don't have to lay off teachers. But we need to stop the way we're doing this. The bidding war that goes on every session needs to stop. We need to make sure that our kids truly are funded first. And we fund them first by setting aside a dedicated amount of money so they can come into this building and talk about education policy and not having to come in here and beg us to give them more money. I think that's the best statement or the state of Oregon can make, that we are willing to set aside dedicated, long-term, stable funding so these teachers and the parents and the children can count on a long-term, stable fund for education. It's a proposal we're bringing forward. I'm hoping that this committee, along with the House and some revenue committees, will take this issue up. Let's look at it and try to come to some consensus that it's time to stop this madness.
Speaker Minnis, thank you for coming here, and out of respect for your office and out of respect for you, I will not debate your proposal at this time, and I would ask my colleagues to do that at this time either.
And Senator Devlin?
Since it's not on the agenda.
I am more than, it's not on the agenda. But I would welcome your participation, and if we can change the plan, I am flexible. But I think the way we have done it to date doesn't work anymore. Senator Devlin, I would welcome your participation in crafting a plan that makes long-term stable funding available to our kids in this state. I appreciate the indulgence of this committee and your time here this morning. Thank you
very much. And thank you, members of the audience here. We've heard from about 40 members of the public this morning. We apologize for the limited amount of time we have within this time frame to take public testimony. I do understand that in sometime in the next month we will be out on the road, so there will be more opportunities to testify. Again, thank you for all coming. I will close this committee meeting for today and close the hearings for SB 5509 and SB 55.
I know that very well.